You're listening to Beyond Bourbon Street, an insider's guide to New Orleans. Beyond Bourbon Street is the podcast where we explore the food, music, culture, places, and people that make New Orleans unique. Whether you are planning a trip, living in New Orleans, or simply wanting a taste of the Crescent City from wherever you are, you've come to the right place. And now, your host, Mark Bologna.
Hey, y'all, this is Mark. Welcome to episode 59. On the last show, we took a trip out to St. Francisville and the Myrtles Plantation, about 2 hours from New Orleans, just outside Baton Rouge. My wife and I spent 2 nights at the Myrtles, which is rumored to be one of the most haunted homes in America. The Myrtles has been featured on numerous television shows about ghosts and spirits, so we thought we'd check it out ourselves. We spent some time with Morgan Moss, whose family owns the plantation, and with Miss Esther Eby, who keeps Morgan in line and keeps the place running. Listen in and learn about the history of the Myrtles, including the spirits that roam the grounds. Morgan also took us on a tour of St. Francisville, and I gotta say, there was a whole lot more to do than we anticipated. We stopped in at Angola Prison to see the museum. We checked out a couple other nearby plantations, and a whole lot more. It was a fun trip and a great discussion. If you're ever looking for a stop on the way to New Orleans or a getaway from the city, you'll enjoy this episode. If you missed it, go back and give it a listen. In today's show, I sit down with a member of the Texas Guitar Hall of Fame. He also happens to be one of the founding members of the New Orleans rock band, Cowboy Mouth. If you've seen a Cowboy Mouth show, you're familiar with Fred LeBlanc, who holds court behind the drums that sit right at the front of the stage. While Fred leads a nightly party that is Cowboy Mouth, just to his right is a hard-rocking, soulful guitar player. I decided to find out more about that guy, Mr. John Thomas Griffith. Even if you never heard of Cowboy Mouth, I think you'll enjoy this discussion if you like music of almost any genre. We talk about Griff's days growing up in New Jersey, Texas, and New Orleans. You'll hear about his exploits with the Red Rockers, with Cowboy Mouth, and more. Make sure you stay with us all the way through. Near the end, Griff gets into this discussion of the time the boys got to play with none other than Mr. Bo Diddley. Before we jump in, though, a quick word about our sponsor, Lionheart Prints. You might remember Liz Marty Cook, the chief enthusiast over at Lionheart, from episode 51. That was the one where we featured three New Orleans business owners, Liz, Kristen from Home Alone, and Patty over at Chop Industries. If you're headed to New Orleans for French Quarter Fest, for Jazz Fest, or just a fun weekend, be sure to stop in and check out Lionheart. It's on Magazine Street, just off Louisiana Avenue, and it's clustered among a great group of stores. You'll find beautiful hand-lettered cards and prints, one-of-a-kind offerings by local artists, some cool t-shirts, and a whole lot more. I love my Who's Your Crawdaddy t-shirt, and I plan on wearing my Everywhere Else It's Just Tuesday shirt until next Mardi Gras, which is about 51 weeks away as I record this, by the way. They also have lots of other things, and lately they've been offering some really cool workshops, including a recent one teaching people how to do hand lettering. Come check out Lionheart Prints and say hi to Liz, to Morgan the Pressman, to Allison, and the whole gang over there. And remember to use the code BEYONDBOURBON at checkout or in the store to save $5 off any t-shirt. With that, let's jump into my discussion with John Thomas Griffith. Hey y'all, my guest today is a singer-songwriter. He's best known probably as a guitarist and vocalist in the rock band Cowboy Mouth, but he's also a member of the Texas Guitar Hall of Fame. I'm so excited to show you a different view of Cowboy Mouth today. Welcome to the show, Mr. John Thomas Griffith.
Thank you, Mark.
How you doing?
I'm glad to be here. Thank you for taking the time.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah. So for our listeners, we are out somewhere in the middle of the Gulf of Mexico on a ship right now. We're looking at 6-foot waves probably here. We are both here on the Rock Boat, which is hosted by Sister Hazel and Bare Naked Ladies and a bunch of other bands. It's a great way, this is not a commercial, by the way, for Six Man, but it's a great way to hang out and hear great music, maybe artists you know, maybe artists you don't. And you guys have been on the boat a bunch over the years.
This is our eighth. I think they're counting, they did a rock slope in Steamboat Springs about, I would say, about 10 years ago that they didn't continue, but I think they count that as a notch in your belt.
Got it.
For Rock Boat. So but this is our eighth.
Wow, and this is the 18th year that Sister Hazel has done this. And one of the things, it's a great opportunity to just get to hang out and get to see musicians and see musicians play different sets in different venues. But it was an opportunity for me to bring you guys, the listeners, some insight into, we're going to talk about Cowboy Mouth, the great New Orleans band. We're also going to sort of dive into your history, John, and get to know you a bit. But first of all, since we're on the boat, you guys, Bare Naked Ladies, many years ago, you guys did a couple tours with them. them, if I remember.
Yes, they were very gracious. They took us out on the road here and in regions that we hadn't really established in America yet.
Yeah.
They were very gracious to take us out on the road with them. It was a long tour. We did a lot of cities that we had never hit before, and then we'd go back and in that respect, it really bolstered our fan base.
Yeah. I actually saw you guys open for them in Minneapolis.
Oh, my God. That's the one date that sticks in my mind. I'm going to tell you why, and that's because it was so cold. And I remember walking outside and walking around from the hotel to the Target Center, and the wind was whipping, and it had to be like minus 10 degrees.
It was crazy. So I moved from New Orleans to Minneapolis, lived there for 2 years, and Paul Sanchez, who we'll talk about later on, gave me a pass. I was in, and, you know, it was amazing to watch. I was an arena tour for Bare Naked Ladies. It was in the late 90s. They were really popular.
They're huge, yeah.
And to watch you guys come out, I think there was three acts. You guys were the second, as I recall, and the stadium not knowing what to expect.
Yeah.
And so this band Cowboy Mouth comes rolling out. And I want to get into your history, but let's talk just a minute about, for people that don't know, what is Cowboy Mouth? How would you describe the band?
I think we're kind of an amalgamation of like New Orleans history, punk, pop, and Americana, you know, in a roundabout way. Our repertoire just covers so much different genres of music, funk, acoustic, singer-songwriter, punk rock.
Yeah.
You know, there's a lot of punk rock in Fred and I. You know, still left.
If you've never seen Cowboy Mouth, so Cowboy Mouth is four people, currently four guys, and maybe the thing that immediately strikes new people in the face is that the drummer, Fred LeBlanc, his drum set is front and center.
Yes, and that's that was on purpose. You know, he wanted everybody to be aligned. It's not that he's up front.
Right.
It's basically that everybody's in line up front together. We all kind of...
Yeah, in a row. All,
yeah,
absolutely.
Row, up front. I know he jokes and he says he didn't want to look at any more guitar players' asses,
right,
or butts, and he would. So that's why he moved up front. But it's strictly that he wants to be up front with us, and we're all in the line.
Yeah, and yeah. I think I've seen it described in other interviews that Cowboy Mouth is sort of a mashup of if the Neville Brothers and the Clash had a baby.
Yes,
it would be Cowboy Mouth, and I think that's kind of a...
That's a pretty... Yeah, Fred pretty much nailed it on the head with that.
I might
slogan.
Throw in a little bit of Bo Diddley, a little bit of Texas rock.
You got to throw in all the old influences like Bo Diddley in the 50s and 60s, and I mean we're a little bit older crowd, you know. I guess is our demographic, but we still think that kids dig what we do, and when we play Jazz Fest in New Orleans, you know, we have a slogan. We will play for anyone from 8 to 80.
Right.
They all get it, and you know, it's all fun. We want everybody to have fun, so they have a good time.
You know, and so Cowboy Mouth has been around more than 25 years. You guys were founded in the early 90s, I think.
1991, yep. Mm-hmm.
So let's go way back. So you grew up in Texas, right?
I was born in Lubbock, Texas, okay. 1960, and my parents moved around a lot. My father was a chemical engineer and an architect. And he worked for a company called Hunt Wesson Foods, which ketchup and Wesson oil and snack packs. And I grew up on snack pack, by the way. Hearty diet of snack packs.
You don't look like it. So
No. Why? You learn real fast what's in it when your dad works for the company, and you're like, maybe not.
Sure.
No. But we moved around a lot. I grew up in Houston, Southern California, New Jersey, down to New Orleans, and just stayed in New Orleans as an adult. I lived there for till 2000 or something like that, and moved to Atlanta.
So how did you were in a band called the Red Rockers,
right?
I don't know how many people still remember that, but you guys were really a hard driving kind of punk rock band.
We were very much punk rock, yeah.
But you guys had a big hit.
The China was 1983.
In the midst of the MTV generation.
Well, we started out as a punk band, like you said, American punk band, and Rolling Stone even wrote an article and proclaimed us as the America's version of the Clash.
Yeah.
And that was a great compliment. And there was a lot of bands we were likened to, DOA, The Dills, with a lot of stuff out of New York City, like the Ramones. And those were our influences, you know. James Singletary and I went to high school together, and we got out of high school. We found that we we like this new thing called punk rock. And when you're living in New Orleans and you're kind of like on the west bank of the city, and you're it's a little bit country.
Yeah, yeah.
And a little less rock and roll, right. If you know what I'm saying. And so your friends look at you like, what are you playing that stuff for, man? Why don't you stick to like Charlie Daniels and Marshall Tucker, man? I said, I love that stuff and I grew up on it, you know. And I played piano growing up as a kid from 6 years old. Actually, I still have my baby grand that my parents bought in 1966. I grew up on Billy Joel and Elton John playing, you know, pop piano. I played classical until I just said, you know, I don't want to play this classical shit anymore. I want to get a pop music teacher. And my mom got me a pop piano player. And I learned all this stuff like that and some jazz. I remember specifically, it was my father brought home this African-American man named Glenn Miller for dinner. He was a really great guy. But my mom, parents are, they go, hey, go play something on the piano for Mr. Miller. You know, and I'm like, okay. So I sit down, and I just knew some pop tunes. And he came over and sat on the piano bench with me and taught me this blues riff, which changed my life. I could get goosebumps just thinking about it. Just sitting there as like, you know, a 13, 14-year-old kid, and this guy's like revealing the world. This is it. I mean, it was a blues third thing, and it was a little run. And as soon as I mastered that, you take off in all different directions with it, you know. And I wish he was around today. I'd say, dude, you know why I'm here? Because of you on that piano bench in 1974. So anyway, I got tired of that stuff, and I found punk rock. I found Tom Petty.
Okay.
You know, in 1977, I bought that first record, and I was like, wow, this is cool. Of course, all my friends go, well, that's punk rock, new wave, or whatever. I said, dude, it's not even close. What are you talking about? They had no idea. Yeah. I had an album by Blondie, I think, was her first record, and I really got into it. So I talked to James one day, and he said, hey, man, I hear you're into that kind of new wave stuff. Then I said, yeah, but I don't know where to get it. Where do you buy that stuff? And where do you listen to it? He goes, you come over to my house on Tuesday night, and we'll turn on the radio on WTUL, which is Tulane University's underground station. So I went over to his house on that Tuesday night, and we got stoned, and we turned on the radio, and it was all this stuff I'd never even heard before. And the great thing about it was I wasn't a guitar player. I knew how to play a little some chords and stuff by this point. We're like 19, you know. When we graduated from high school, James and I both, I went to LSU, but my third year I went to UNO, and James was going too. So we'd carpool from the West Bank together, lived down the street from each other. Well, we played punk rock all the way there and back, and we became friends with some other punk rockers at UNO. And there's the punk rock scene in New Orleans in 1978, you could count everybody in the scene on one hand. That was the other band, Normals or something like that.
Right.
But we started going out to see these bands, you know, the little punk bands, and really got into it. And we realized that we don't have to be masters of our instrument to play this stuff. All you need to do is three chords, learn the Chuck Berry riff, or the Keith Richards riff, or the Johnny Thunders riff. They're all the same. Just goes by different eras. And, you know, you're in. So we started learning stuff off the radio. And this guy, John G. was his name, and he had this Tuesday night radio show on Tulane Radio, WTUL, from 7 to 10. And we just sit there and just immerse ourselves every Tuesday. I mean, I couldn't wait for Tuesday to roll around, because I knew I would go over to James, we'd turn on the radio, and we'd try to learn some of these God Save the Queen or whatever, the Sex Pistols that we were learning, Dan Buzzcocks. We were learning everything we could absorb, you know. And we decided, hey, man, let's start a band. It was just pretty that simple. Just one afternoon to his house, you know, let's start a band. We can do this. So we started looking for a bass player, and that was a little bit tougher than we thought it was, because we put up a flyer in the local music store, Sound City, and nobody called us the whole summer. And then come roll around, we roll back into UNO for the fall semester, and this guy calls us, says, hey, I'll meet you in the UC at such and such at 12. And so we're sitting there waiting for him. And he walks in the door. And as soon as he walked in the door, we both went, that's the guy. I mean, you could just tell it was Darren.
Sure.
I mean, Darren he looked like Pete Farndon from The Pretenders. You know, that black hair and stuff. And so he beelined right towards us. He knew we were at the, I guess, because by this time I'd probably had dyed my hair white or something like that, punk spiky, you know. So anyway, that's how we started, you know. We were all from the West Bank, same neighborhood. And that just so happened that Darren was from our neighborhood. We didn't know that going into it. So I thought, how lucky is that? So that was the beginnings, yeah.
And you guys had it was relatively short-lived, but you guys had a great following back then.
We had fun. But we started out, we loved punk rock. To get to your China comment, there's a lot of stuff that goes on behind the scenes that developed that whole thing. One was that 415 Records had just signed an imprint deal with Columbia. We saw it as an opportunity to jump up to another level.
Sure.
And we saw it right out of the box. We said we could either write, we have an opportunity to be better songwriters, or we just stay in the punk rock genre and just putt along, you know, and do whatever. But we consciously sat down and said, let's write good songs. Let's start being good songwriters or do the best we can.
Sure.
So we came up with China, and we had a couple of songs like Good as Gold on there, and it was our second single. So it was a conscious effort. We knew that if we had a chance that Columbia would put money behind us, we'd take it. Now, the other thing is, the other side of that, the punk rockers, they were like, oh, you guys sold out. And I go, yeah, well, I'm selling out the House of Blues. I'm selling out here. I'm selling out here. That's so nice. That's the way we joke about it. But they hated us, the purists.
Right.
I mean, the Dead Kennedy types, you know.
Well, it's fun. I mean, every once in a while, you guys drop China into the set with Cowboy Mouth.
Yeah, we do.
It's fun to watch. I mean, now here we are in 2018. A lot of people have no context of it.
Oh, yeah. We walk into venues and we play that song, and they look on their face like, what is this song? I haven't heard this. It's not on any Cowboy Mouth record. But it is, but it's in a different vein.
Right. Yeah, and so that's one of the things I really wanted people to get to know about. So almost at about the same time, Fred's over in Dash Rip Rock a little bit later than you guys, kind of a punk band as well, kind of a little bit Clash.
Well, in the early days when we were, this is how I met Fred and Paul. They were in a band called the Backbeats,
right.
And now they were ska kind of, more like Americana, like Joe Ely. Yeah. Like, I must have not have got a lot of love last night. You know, stuff like that. Really upbeat rockabilly. Rockabilly actually had a really cool little run there during that time period of the early 80s, mid 80s. There was Blue Vipers. There were, the Backbeats. There was another band, a really good rockabilly band. But that was, the rockabilly kind of had a little a string attached to punk rock. You know how they all kind of blended together there in the early 80s.
And you feel both of them in Cowboy Mouth today.
Yes.
Particularly on your side of the stage. But and although Matt and Brian as well, you feel that those vibes come through in different tracks today.
Well, thank you. I'm glad. I hope so.
You can see the lineage from Texas to the punk to the rockabilly, all kind of feed in there. Some of the soul, the gospel. It all does blend together.
There's a lot. We know that. I forgot to add gospel. That's a very important part of our makeup. Gospel, folk, you know, I mean, everything we grew up on. I mean, Fred and I feel very fortunate that we grew up in an era where there was so much diversity.
Sure.
Funk, R&B. I mean, we love everything R&B, man, old school, the Stack stuff, you know, the old recordings, you know, we collect that stuff. We can't get enough of it still because we know that these kids these days don't have that.
Right.
They think they're getting, I don't know what they think they're getting, but I know they're not getting the stuff that we got. And we've got a hearty diet of Elvis, Rudy Valley. I'm just making stuff up. I mean, in my house, it was hee-haw.
So how did you and Fred and Paul, and I guess Steve Walters back then, right?
Well, Steve was in a band called The Normals.
Okay.
Now, when I was 19 and James and I were listening to those Tuesday night, we'd go out on the weekend and go see The Normals. They were the only punk band within a 1,000-mile radius of us. So we took that, and we'd go, and we'd pogo, and we'd jump up and down. It was fun. And we said, man, we knew in the back of our minds, we want to be up there, not down here. They had a couple other bands around town, and once we joined, we started a Red Rock, or we were called Rat Finks originally, to be honest with you. We were called the Rat Finks, and we started writing songs kind of with big influence was Stiff Little Fingers and The Clash, and more like political-sided stuff. So we kind of went that direction. The first song we wrote, Darren and I wrote together, was Guns of Revolution. I had that little riff, And he had some great lyrics, so he came with the Guns Revolution stuff. But that's kind of when we started doing that, it was like, wait, we can't be Rat Finks and singing about like revolution and you know, turn things upside down. So we changed. He came up. It was actually Dills song called Red Rockers. It was a B-side okay. on one of their big singles, and it was called Red Rockers Rule. And he just took the rule off and said, "Hey man, I got a name for the band now." And we all went, "Whoa, that's great! Let's do it. Nice. Yeah, let's keep it." Yeah.
So how did it come to be the Cowboy Mouth before? How did you guys all? So you all knew each other then. You're all in the same circles.
Well, when I meant to say that earlier. When, the way I met Paul and Fred was they were in the Backbeats, and they would open for Red Rockers. So when we had gone to California, we packed up the truck and moved to Beverly. We went to San Francisco, and our drummer quit on the way. Our original drummer, Jeff Greenberg, and he didn't tell us. So we got to Los Angeles in Hollywood, and literally we're standing on Sunset Boulevard with no drummer, and we got a gig in San Francisco, I think, the following weekend, going, holy crap, what are we going to do? So fortunately, we had opened for X a couple times in New Orleans. We'd kind of become, like, for bands like that from out of town, Red Rockers became the perennial opener, okay. like the go-to band. So I had kept John Doe's phone number in my wallet. And I said, well, you know, we got, what other choice do we have? So I called his number. I was going to ask him, hey, man, do you know any drummers? We're in Hollywood and we're stuck, and see if he'd help us out. Well, the guy, this is back when they had answering services in Hollywood. Yeah. And you call, not even an answer machine. You had a service where a guy would pick up and go, well, he's not here right now. I can take a message. I'll give it to him. So the guy that answered the phone was Patrick Jones. And he said, well, he's not here right now. And I kind of said, well, tell him we're looking for a drummer. And he goes, well, what kind of music are you into? I thought from an operator, and I was like, right. That was kind of took me, excuse me? I said, well, what kind of music do you guys like? I was like, you know, the Clash, Sex Pistols, that, you know, punk rock genre. He goes, dude, I love that stuff. I want to be your drummer. I'm on the phone, I'm like going, okay, where are you? And this is all bang, bang, bang. And he goes, well, I'm the Taft Building at Vine and Hollywood Boulevard. Come meet me, I'm on the fourth floor. And we all looked at each other, well, what do we got to lose? That's how we found Patrick for our first album. And that's where it really got tight, you know, yeah. The punk rock really synced in. and then we would come back home, and Paul and Fred had this band called The Backbeats, and they would open for us, and we'd play like at Jimmy's. And there was a place called Jed's at the time, owned by Jed Palmer. And, he was a character. I got to tell you, I love New Orleans because of the characters they have. I mean, I've known so many crazy people that I don't think life would have been fun without them. You know, I love crazy people.
Well,
like
I'm going to circle back to Jimmy's in a minute. Once you finish off the how the band formed. We'll
talk so that's you. How we all met. You know, and shortly after that, you know, I was in and out of town. I'd run into Paul at the music store, the guitar store. He'd be walking in. I'm walking out. You know, he'd go, hey, man, how's it going? Hey, and I said, and we'd always look at each other and go, hey man, we should get together and play sometime. We always say, and we'd joke about it years later, and he'd go, and he always says, oh, that was John Griffith from Red Rockers. Oh my God, he asked me to play with him. I'm like, I never think of it that way, you know, and I thought it was cute.
Right.
But anyway, Paul and I started getting together. I'd go over to his house and we'd start strumming acoustics. And what I found in Paul was he had this lexicon of country music that was like phenomenal, and could remember lyrics from like songs from the 20s, 30s, 40s, and I just thought that was phenomenal. And I kind of taught, I remember telling him, I said, dude, I want to play with you because I want to learn all this song, this music, this country stuff that I grew up on, but I don't know a lot of it. You know, there's Woody Guthrie and stuff like that. I just wanted him to bring that to me. I wanted to soak it up, and I've always been a music lover, and at my house was always music everywhere. My mom was a big Elvis fan, Rudy Valley. They loved country, Willie Nelson. Grew up all the Texas greats, Waylon. And of course, like I said, my dad was a huge fan of Hee Haw. And we would listen to the Grand Ole Opry on Saturday night. Dad would gather us all and we'd just listen. And it was a lot of fun, man. It's growing up was...
Well, you know what's interesting to me as I listen to you, Griff, is in the early days of Cowboy Mouth. So I came to love Cowboy Mouth from the very, very beginning. I actually saw, I think, Fred's last performance with Dash Riprock when he announced at that show that he was leaving. A guy named Kyle Molosson was taking his seat, and he was starting this band called Cowboy Mouth. I was in Lafayette. I went to USL at the time. And Paul was a customer, so longtime listeners know my family owned a po' boy place called Teddy's Grill on Franklin Avenue in Gentilly.
Right,
And Paul was a customer, and I remember one day my sister saying, "Hey, you know who that is?" I was like, "Yeah, it's Paul. He comes in 3 days a week." And she said, "No, they just started this band, Cowboy Mouth." So we saw you guys early on. But one of the things, as you were talking about all that, one of the things that struck me is all four of you guys have all said you came from families where music was omnipresent and all different kinds of music. And I think even today you hear that when you guys are on stage, you can close your eyes and you can hear the singer-songwriter, you can hear the rockabilly, you can hear a little bit of the Clash.
Mm-hmm.
You get just this real amalgamation, I think you said, is a great... Certainly you get the New Orleans funk and the Meters
yes.
and the Nevilles in there, but it all comes together in a way that... I'm biased because I'm from New Orleans and I've been a fan of Cowboy Mouth for 25 years, but it comes together in a way that, listeners, you might not hear in a lot of other bands. It's such a combination. And when you sort of, if you lay it out on paper, you think this is not going to work, you know?
Yeah, it doesn't look, yeah.
But it does
But
work.
It does. Well, you know, it's funny because when you're writing stuff and or you're recording more or less stuff, you'll play a riff or something and you'll, days later, months later, you'll realize where that riff came from in your subconscious. It'll hit you all of a sudden. You'll be on the road in a gas station, you know, and they're like, "Oh, wait, that riff I wrote and or played in like such and such a song, I know what that's from the Four Tops or something. That's from some, I remember this or lick or something." It just comes in your subconscious and you don't realize it when you're writing it. But everything, of course, it's all been done,
right,
to quote the Bare Naked Ladies.
Right. Right.
And so you just roll with it, and it's fun because I make it a game, you know, like, where did I get that from, you know, and I realize, oh, that's such and such a song, I stole that from.
In those early days too, you certainly could hear the going back and forth across the stage too,
mm-hmm.
almost in the different genres as you guys would bounce back and forth across the stage, you could
right.
hear that,
mm-hmm.
And I think, did you guys? Definitely there's a Bo Diddley influence in there.
Oh,
and
big time.
And
yeah.
In one of those early albums, I think maybe it was a live album you guys recorded in France, I want to say.
Yes.
I think you guys even talked about Bo Diddley. Did you ever come across him? Did you guys
yes,
ever?
Yes, well, the first time we met him, we had been invited to Charlotte, North Carolina to play an open for him and be in his band.
Okay, I didn't know that.
Yeah, a lot of these old guys like that, legends like Chuck Berry and Bo Diddley, what they do is they go to a town and they get there and ask the promoter or the club owner, "Okay, we need a band tonight and to back up Mr. Diddley." So they would get a local band, and usually a lot of times the band would have no clue who Bo Diddley was or what his songs were like. I've seen a lot of people do that with Chuck Berry. Like, they get up there and they have no clue, and I'll never forget, we played with Chuck Berry, opened for Chuck Berry, and they had a band, local band, playing as his backup band, and they had no clue, like Maybelline. 1, 2, 3, 4. What? We don't know. I don't know this song. Yeah, like, and I swear, Fred and Paul and I were standing on the side of the stage, going, "Dude, let's just kick these guys to the curb and get it on. We know these songs. Yeah, you know? We know like the back of our hand." Just stuff like, yeah. There's a lot of funk. I miss Paul for that purpose. You know, he was a very funky songwriter.
Yeah.
Voodoo Shop's a great song. You know, mm-hmm. one of the classic example of his funk, you know.
Yeah, you know, and again, for listeners that don't know, Cowboy Mouth, we're going to talk about its sort of present makeup in a few minutes, but in the early days, you know, you and Paul Sanchez, longtime listeners will know, we interviewed Paul, I want to say it was about episode 13 of the Beyond Bourbon Street podcast, and talked about his role in those early days of the Backbeats and going to Cowboy Mouth. But there was you could tell that each of you brought something different in that mix across the stages. And,
yeah.
And Paul definitely brought, I think, sort of the singer-songwriter, folksy.
New Orleans.
Yeah.
A lot of New Orleans.
More
so
than any
about
New Orleans.
Yeah.
Of course, Hurricane Party, which
right.
later came to have a different meaning. But that song was
yeah.
written long before Katrina.
Yes.
And was really a tale of what many people in New Orleans experience at hurricanes,
yeah.
right?
Just well, I was at the party. It was there. It happened. Yeah.
But I think, you know, it was fun to watch back then, you guys sort of gel and then grow up together and sort of the New Orleans music scene mm-hmm. grow up. And then I wonder, you know, as we got to, you guys were pretty solid for a long time. You had a
yeah.
couple, you know, a little bit of a Spinal Tap situation in terms of bassist changing
right.
out, but Rob Savoy came along and was with you guys for about a decade, I think.
Yep. And Rob Savoy was great. He was in a band called the Blue Runners, which were from Lafayette, Louisiana. Yeah. And they would play with us, you know, open for us at Junior Jazz Fest or whatever, at Jimmy's.
Yep.
And I remember this one time I was looking at Blue Runners were opening for us, and I was watching them from the side of the stage at Jimmy's. And they had this guy, Russ Broussard, playing drums. And he and Rob were locked in so tight as a bass, as a rhythm unit, that it just it was fun. I was taken back. I was like, wow, that's really tight. That's what a bass and drums should sound like.
Well, and when Rob, so I went to USL when it was USL in Lafayette, and used to see the Blue Runners. And when Rob came in, it added yet another layer because it added that sort of
that Cajun-y kind of like Louisiana hot sauce. You know,
Paul had written "Maggie Don't Two-Step."
Oh yes, great song.
It was a great song by itself. And then I remember when Rob came in, Rob would sing it sometimes or often.
Uh-huh.
And it just kind of added that chank-a-chank sort of Lafayette
rhythm.
Well,
you know,
to
when
it.
Rob came in, you know, we had added Paul added the one of the verses in Cajun French,
right?
And basically, Rob had translated it and written it out for him so he could pronounce it right. And so, Maggie, je n'ai pas fait bon.
Yeah.
Like, not having a good time or something like that.
And so Rob was with you guys for a long time. Just a little bit of an insider note. I haven't interviewed Rob yet. I will at some point because now Rob, he's been off the road for a while, been out of Cowboy Mouth for a while, but he's really ingrained with Quint Davis and Jazz Fest.
Yes. Uh-huh.
He's really, ingrained. When you come to Jazz Fest and you see all those artists, Rob is...
He's the reason they're there.
Right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So it's been an interesting... Sad to see him not on the road as much anymore, although sometimes he's got another band, but the...
String beans.
That love influence lives on, though, in New Orleans music. So there's something for you listeners when you go to Jazz Fest. There's a Cowboy Mouth influence there.
Yeah.
You know, through Rob Savoy and all that. But, you know, getting back to Cowboy Mouth, one of the things from the early days, you guys have been a hard touring band. A couple hundred shows a year.
A couple hundred shows a year. We were traveling in a little Nissan, one of those little boxy vans they had in the mid-90s. The stuff would be sliding forward, Fred would slam on the brakes, and the guitar would hit you in the back of the head. That kind of stuff you don't see.
And you guys did that kind of schedule for a long, long time.
Yeah. Well, Fred joined the band. We had a manager. He had a female manager. And, you know, basically, he had a deal with EMI that fell through. And he asked his manager, basically, what should I do now? And she said, you should form a band and go back to those places Dash Rip Rock played and just blow the walls off the place, you know, and just take it to a new level. And that's what we did. A lot of the places we first played in Louisiana were old Dash Rip Rock haunts that they had knocked out and chiseled out and, you know, for us. So it was already set. There was a lot of, you know, stuff going on. You know, also out of the box, our first gig was at Carrollton Station. And, you know, it was one of those things where... a lot of word of mouth, and it was just like, you know, 600 people showed up, and you can only fit like 150 in there or something like that.
So Carrollton Station, for listeners, it's still there. Yeah. Carrollton Station is right on Carrollton Avenue near the streetcar barn. That's why it's called Carrollton Station. It's a tiny, I'm looking in the room we're in now, which is much bigger than Carrollton Station.
Uh-huh.
And you would be jammed into a little area,
cool. Just like that.
Like 12 feet wide, tiny stage, I don't know, 6 inches off the floor.
Yep.
And Cowboy Mouth would pack in there. I remember Paul's mom would often come to shows there.
Yes.
And you'd be packed in there, and Cowboy Mouth would start and just rip the place apart.
Yeah.
It was so loud and so vibrating through that place.
And intense, yeah. Mm-hmm.
But those were kind of, the gigs were so personal. And so, you know, it was very hard to almost see the difference between the band and the crowd. And everyone knew the lyrics and the... And you mentioned Jimmy's earlier. So Jimmy's was a club a block away from there.
Oh, no, it was across the street.
Is it right?
On the same opposite corner.
Oh, that's right. And
the
I remember,
was across there,
I think it was going to be the last show at Jimmy's, and the power went out or something. And I remember Fred picking up the bass drum and you guys going out into the street.
Oh, I remember that. Yes, we did. We had wireless. We all walked out in the street and just played.
And played the gig in the street there on the corner.
And that
was the way Cowboy Mouth... It still is that way, I think, for listeners. If you've never experienced Cowboy Mouth's show, we saw it on the ship. This week, I've gotten to see you guys a couple times. And it's fun to watch people. I'm curious about your perspective. There's obviously people like me that have seen the show 100 times, but it's the people that have no idea what to expect.
Yeah, the rookies.
And this drummer comes out with a ripped up shirt, usually a Saint shirt. He's got no shoes on. Uh-huh. And he's, you know, we're Cowboy Mouth. We're from New Orleans. And we're going to bring you into New Orleans for the next 90 minutes.
Yes.
And people just don't know what to do with that.
And they go, wow, that's what New Orleans is like? Oh, boy. I either want to stay away or I want to go down there and check it out, you know?
Is that what it feels like from the stage when you...
Yeah, I feel like I'm bringing Texas to the people. I'm doing my part is that I'm bringing the southern, just southern United States, basically to newcomers. Yeah. A little bit of Texas, a little bit of Southern California.
Here I Sit in Prison is a song that's almost always in the set. You've written many songs, but Here I Sit in Prison, I think really, if you're listening, you've never heard a Cowboy Miles show, as soon as you're done listening to this podcast, stop and go find Here I Sit in Prison by Griff. But it just kind of pulls that together. It's a hard driving Texas rock.
It's one of those old storytelling type, like Willie Nelson, Waylon Jennings, you know, Billy Joe Shaver, those cats that told stories in their songs, you know, about people are normal people and are just had problems, and, you know, we could all relate to. I know I was in the back of the bus. We were on some road tour. We had finally gotten a bus, and Paul came to me in the back and started playing the verses. He had no chorus. He just had this, like, you know, here I sit in prison, guilty of a crime. He told this little story, and I said, man, you need some kind of something that takes it to the next level, like brings the chorus up. So I said, why don't you just do like Yippee-Yi-Yay or something like that? And he got to it and he went up to the A chord. I went, Yippee-Yi-Yay? It's like, dude, that's our chorus. I said, Yippee-Yi-Yo, here I sit in prison. Yeah, so that's a really cool example of how Paul and I wrote together. Yeah.
And that song comes together so well, I think, in Cowboy Mouth, because you get the driving parts, and even today you got Matt and Brian and Fred come together, and each are just so good at their piece of that. Mm-hmm. And I think I've seen you do that sitting at a piano, certainly see you with the guitar. It's got a little bit of a David Allan Coe feel to me, like you could be sitting in a bar drinking.
I've got a song for you, man.
You know, it's got that sitting in a bar drinking 25 cent PBR,
right,
and that kind of song comes on, and everybody's just rocking to it.
Yeah,
right?
I gets into it. That's what I'm. I do miss. I of course Paul knows this. Like, you know, DeMar, I miss him so much. You know, he's been one of my closest writing partners I'll probably ever have. I can honestly say that. You know, I'll go to my grave, probably never have anybody to write songs with like him. Like, I mean, we just got it. You know, we just look in each other. Minds and just
He's
go I know what you're going to do next, and I know where it's going. Brilliant, you know. It's a lot of fun. I get shots, yeah.
And that came across and still comes across on the Cowboy Mouth stage, that tightness, particularly when you guys play some of those old songs.
Yeah.
You know, and so I would encourage people, if you've never heard Cowboy Mouth, and I imagine some of our listeners haven't, go find some tracks, but there's nothing like Cowboy Mouth live. Even the best of the albums doesn't encapsulate the experience of being there in front of
everybody. Says that.
In front of
we know it too, and it's a kind of hard talk.
It's gonna be a hard challenge.
It's a challenge, yeah.
Yeah, but you get a chance. What I love about Cowboy Mouth is you guys still tour pretty hard. Not as hard as you did, but pretty hard.
Yeah, we're doing about 125 a year now.
So there's an opportunity, if you love New Orleans and you aren't in New Orleans, to see you guys as you come around the country, and it's an experience like no other band.
No, you know, we do bring the South to you, man.
So I want to jump forward a little bit. Obviously, when Katrina hit, it not only tore apart the city, but it was really tough on the band. You know, Paul's home was destroyed.
Yep.
And it caused you guys a pretty big shift. I think Paul left pretty soon after Katrina. And what was that time like and an adjustment for you guys as a band? And
it was heartbreaking. You know, here's one of my best friends and his heart's totally covered in water. It was 4 years after he left. In 2005, he left the band. Or 16, to 2006. It was 16 years in. He'd been with us for 16 years. Katrina happened. A weird time. We were recording Voodoo Shop in Atlanta when it went down. Mm. And we were watching it from afar, you know, on TV. So we really didn't know the specific impact that it was having. We just kind of go, you know, you see hurricanes on TV go through Florida and you go, oh, they'll be okay.
Yep.
It'll be all right. It'll be okay. Everybody else, yeah. But man, this was, when the levee broke, man, that it was the storm surge and the flood of water coming in from the Gulf that caused the major damage.
I remember calling my dad. I was living in D.C. at the time and said, hey, it looks like we had a restaurant. We had a house that backed up against one of the levees that broke.
Oh, wow.
And I said, it looks like it's going to be all right, huh? And he said, no, the water's, you know. The water's rising the day after, you know, storm's okay, but the rest is not going to be okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that same thing for you guys. You're watching it remotely, and you don't know. You don't know.
Yeah. You just think, okay, everything's going to be all right. It's going to be okay. We'll get through this. And it's a, but I mean, Category 5 is nothing to shake a stick at. You know, it's. I remember being a kid in 1965, and I think it was Betsy came through Houston on the Gulf Coast, and our lights were out for 3 days, and I was like, wow. Yeah.
And you've seen it repeat now in Houston, you know, with the hurricane earlier this year and all the damage it did there. But that really, at the time, it felt like not only was the city recovering, but for the music community, Cowboy Mouth is such an integral part of the city.
Well, you really get to see how resilient that city is when what the music does and its importance to that resiliency. How much it's very much a part of that comeback.
And you saw that at the first Jazz Fest after. You know, there was a lot of talk that next spring about, do we have Mardi Gras? Do we have Jazz Fest? You know, I'll never forget some of the performances there, particularly at Gentilly Stage, and you'd look out and you could see the blue tarps on the houses on the other side of the fence. And that was a pretty emotional Jazz Fest. And coming out of that, you guys wrote a bunch of songs that I didn't hear in the current set this week, but things like The Avenue.
And I Want to Go Home.
And I Want to Go Home.
Right.
You know, and talking about those experiences and trying to put them in perspective, I think, in a rock context. And, they were really powerful.
It was a hardcore. I mean, watching my friend lose his entire... I mean, we went back. We went right after, I think, October, we were playing Voodoo Fest, one of the first ones. And they had changed the venue to the Butterfly down on the riverfront.
On the river,
And I remember coming off the I-10 on the Carrollton, and as soon as you got to the bottom of the exit... There were two guys with guns and Humvees blocking Carrollton, and that's when it really hit us hard. This is serious shit, man.
Yeah,
this is screwed up. But
and that really began a path for you guys. So Paul left shortly, within the year, I think.
He left in 2000. What was Katrina? 2005.
2005.
Yeah, he left a year later. Yeah.
And then you guys went to, you had a series of bass players come in, but it was interesting. You had a series of female bass players come in.
Yes.
Mary Lesang and Sonia Tetlow, and a couple others.
Mary Lesang, yeah.
Right.
Mary Lesang, you said that. And Cassandra. Regina.
Yeah.
Zerné, yeah.
And really added a different texture to the band, I think. I don't know if that was intentional, but it was really a cool sort of...
We just had to find a bass player. We wanted to keep doing 200 days a year and gotta move on, you know. In both bands that I've been in my life, this seems like they both replaced a member at some point, and they just... Let's not miss a beat, you know.
Right.
And it's never really thought out. It's just like, we don't have time to think about it. Just let's move on.
Well, and today you have Brian and Matt, both of which have been...
They're fantastic.
Yeah,
oh, my God,
there.
They're so good. Man, Brian Broussard, I can always say, is straight up... He's like what we talked about earlier, about the music. It's in his blood. It's in his DNA. He's a rocker, you know. He loves, you know, classic rock. You know,
and he's got the hair for it.
And Matt can play his butt off. I mean, he's an amazing... You know, he's one of those guys that was 16 and won like a Guitar Center rock-off thing. You know, he became and got studio time, and he's been a phenomenal guitar player since he was a teenager. One of those child prodigy kind of...
Well, one of the reasons I bring it up is you guys now, 25 plus years, you have such a strong catalog and such a mix of, as we've talked about, of genres. And now it is a pretty straightforward, in-your-face rock and roll band with four guys that are great at their craft. And one of the great things about the Rock Boat is you're right there and as intimate as you want to be with the band, and can really sort of admire and enjoy it. Uh-huh. And those guys, it'd been a while since I'd seen Cowboy Mouth live, and to see Matt and Brian there really just rocking hardcore at it.
Well, I had a friend of mine, this guy who works on the Rock Boat, come up to me last night, and we were talking, watching Alan.
Alan Doyle?
Yeah, great guy. And we toured with him. He was in a band called Great Big Sea. And we toured with them, and I totally forgot about it. He comes up to me at the beginning of the boat and he goes, "Hey, Griff, what's going on?" I'm like going, "Who is this guy? Why? How do I know you?" I mean, we've toured with so many bands, it's like ridiculous. But my friend Charlie walks up to me and he goes, "Man, I didn't realize you guys had so much crunch in your sound. What happened?" You know, I said, "Well, that's Brian and Matt. You know, just it's always been there on my side,
right?"
But I just say, you know, I had to facilitate it on the other side. But they bring the really hard, crunchy guitar now. We just a lot more, I wouldn't say metal-y, but just it's a lot in your face,
it's
punchy.
It's a little bit more rock and roll.
Rock and roll,
right?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And to me, it's been interesting to watch, you know, bands change and the vibe changes. But again, you have such a strong catalog, and when people come in, they get to put their take on it. So, you know, to watch Matt on some of those, and again, I'm a longtime fan. I know the catalog. But to hear the same songs played in a different way, you know, each person kind of takes their ownership of that.
Yeah. Unfortunately, I wish we could play some of Ola Paul's. We do Fire, but there's I get my opportunity. I get to play with Paul acoustically, and you know, I'm going to go back a little bit before we formed Cowboy Mouth, or Fred did. Paul and I were once we start writing together before Cowboy Mouth. I'd left Red Rockers and I was doing a solo thing in New Orleans. JT, my own John Thomas Griffith band. I put out Son of an Engineer, which was my first solo album, and Paul and I were tinkering around. I was going to his house, and we were playing like old country songs, and we started to decide, let's do a little duet thing together, and we called it Lonesome Travelers, based on the Jack Kerouac book. Shortly after that, probably a year or so, we were doing like Jets, or Tupelo's it was called now, which was on Oak Street, and we were doing that in the Maple Leaf, and doing a couple acoustic shows around town, and then that's when Fred called me. About a year into that, Paul goes, hey man, I've been playing with John Griffith. Maybe we should call him to play. They didn't have a guitar player. It was just three piece, I think. That's when Fred instigated calling me, and I was like, okay, sure. I remember telling Fred on the phone, I said, he'd give me a little blue cassette. And this little blue cassette became like kind of known as the little blue cassette. Like it was real, if you had that, a collectible thing years later. But on that was like, Why You Want to Do Me, and Any Little Bit, great songs. And so I learned them and showed up rehearsal, and I had they had a little bitty amp for me to play through. And we played the first song, Why You Want to Do Me, and we stopped, and we looked at each other and went, whoa, that was badass. And I said, well, you know, I'm going to bring a Marshall in here, dude. It's going to get a lot louder. I'm just warning you.
Well, you know, and now, so Cowboy Mouth as a band is, maybe people know the song Jenny Says, which was a big hit for you guys in the 90s. And to me, it's fun. It's fun to watch the reaction of the crowd. But it's not Why You Want to Do Me All That. You know, those songs are so sort of iconic to Cowboy Mouth. And you guys just get to sort of let loose on those songs.
Yes.
You know, I think Cowboy Mouth is great. I think you should see them today. I think you guys have this vibrancy as much as you've ever had. I certainly do miss that sort of back and forth. And Paul, and you and Paul together could take it down a notch. Right? So a Cowboy Mouth show to me, and I should
This is between you and me. I don't know if Fred really knows what that means. So, you know, that's why, so you get it.
Yeah, and I'll ask Fred about that when we talk. But
there's no notch on him, dude. It's like on, and that's it.
The curtains come out, and it's 90 minutes of in your
face. Not that that's a bad thing.
No. I just always thought that taking the crowd. So as a crowd participant, 90 minutes is a lot to go, especially getting a little bit older, right? But those little ballads that would come down and the sort of funky New Orleans tales that would come down, it added a nice rhythm to it. I always used to think Cowboy Mouth was... The Cowboy Mouth show was like Finding Religion a little bit. You could go into a gospel tent and you'd be moved. You have your heart pulled out a little bit, and then just want to scream your brains out and jump up and down like you were at a punk rock show. And you get a little of both, and it would kind of feed you through, right? Now it's 90 minutes of jumping up and down, and it's a bit more of a workout these days.
You don't have any lulls, too many lulls. Well, maybe Take Me Back to New Orleans is about the lulls you're going to get.
Absolutely. But it's a participative show.
Well, you know, you had mentioned that it's everybody's akins it to a religious experience.
Yeah.
And I had a woman catch me. I was alone in the hallway by the elevators, and she caught me. She passed me and goes, wait, Mr. Cowboy Mouth. I don't think she knew my name was right off the bat. She goes, I just got to tell you. And she started going into this story about how she was in the crowd at that Vegas country music festival shooting.
Oh, wow.
And she started tearing up. She goes, I love you guys' message. I love the glad to be alive message that you guys pour out. I said, please don't cry. Please. No, not now. So I hugged her and I said, well, I'm glad we could facilitate your, I guess, working this out thing, whatever you're going through with the shooting. And I totally get it. And I'm glad we're here for you. And I'm glad it works. And that's the effect you have on people. It's like, I walked away going, wow, You don't even think about it when you're on stage. You're not thinking about the effect you're having on. You're just trying to get through, make sure you don't fuck up, you know? And, it's little moments like that where it really goes, wow, this is not, this is great. I don't even know how to explain it. It's a feeling that's like, you don't want to get too egotistical on it, but you go, wow, I'm glad I'm helping people.
Well, and I can tell you, and yeah, this is between you and me, because Fred would say, of course. But I think Fred talks about, you guys talk about all the time, you know, we're Cowboy Mouth, we're from New Orleans, and aren't you glad to be alive? And right. This show really is about celebrating that. And having been a fan now for 20-something years, and that's a big chunk of my life, I'm 47, I remember shows at Carrollton Stations, and I remember those Thanksgiving Eve shows at Tipitina's go forever.
Oh, and Rendon Inn shows, they go 4 hours.
And it was very much sort of like going to church for me. You know, sometimes you're high and sometimes you're bummed and you go into a Cowboy Mouth show and you walk out 2 hours, 3 hours, 4 hours later feeling a little bit better about life.
You don't even remember that, why you were bummed out.
And
sometimes
you're celebrating with people you don't know,
right,
and people you do know.
Well,
and
I don't know if you, I grew up in Southern Baptist environment. And the environment was basically, you know, it was church every Sunday, and it's you had your little playlist, I call it, or whatever you want to call it, that, you know, told you what hymn you were going to sing at what time, and when the pass the offering, and when the sermon is, and you know, years later after I was in the band, it hit me, it dawned on me, wow, this is like like going to church on Sunday. It's like you have your sermon, you know, you have the plate offering, you get to meet the guy next to you, shake his hand, high five, whatever.
Right.
And it was just like being in Southern Baptist church.
That's interesting. It always felt to me like building an instant community over 2 hours.
Yes.
Because if you walked in and you didn't know anybody, you were gonna know by the end.
Knowing a couple people, yeah. Uh-huh.
And I think that's held true all these years. Yeah, some of those clubs I remember. One of the other anecdotes is, gosh, I remember Tipitina's, and there was a moment, I think, when Hootie and the Blowfish opened for you guys.
Yes.
And that was right before Cracked Rear View.
Mm-hmm.
And then you guys have remained close to them, I remember.
Yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. They invited us. We were trying to break into, like, the Columbia, Charleston music scene, North Carolina. Before I forget, I know I'm going to go in a lot of tangents here, but one of the things about Bo Diddley, I want to tell you, we're trying to break those markets, you know, when we're new. A friend of ours, Leisure McCorkle, and this Lady Penny had this little small club called The Milestone, but they also promoted stuff in a bigger venue. I can't remember the name of it, but they're the ones who called us and said, hey, will you come open for Bo Diddley, knowing that we'd like drop our drawers and just like run. I'll walk there. Just tell me when it is. Be in his back of it for $100. You know, it's a 15-hour van ride in that little van, right? And we hauled ass to North Charlotte, and we got there. He was everything we expected it to be. Literally, he's frying chicken in one of those electric fryers.
Really?
That your mom had when you were a kid in the backstage. He's frying chicken. And and we walk off stage. I remember we did our set, and we walked off, and he's frying chicken, and it's you could just smell it. And it's the smoke, the greasy smoke everywhere. And Paul, being the verbose gentleman that he is, asked a very important question. So you got any advice for some young whippersnappers like us? He goes, yeah, baby. You know, make it easier and think of church or something like that. And that stuck with us for a bunch of years, yeah. Then we got out and we played in his band. And I don't know if a lot of people realize this, but when you play Bo Diddley stuff, you know, you would think it's chunk, ka-chunk, 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 chunk, chunk. Well, that's his guitar does that. But the drums, if you listen real close, they're just 2 and 4. Boom, chop, boom. Against that rhythm, it really made sense. I didn't realize it. I grew up listening to this stuff. And it wasn't until I met him, or we saw him and played with him, that's how it really should be played.
That's cool.
And that's how they played it in the old days. And when you have somebody, like, you just do boom, chop, boom,
boom, chop.
Just you
boom,
keep doing it.
Chop.
Dunk, 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 dunk. See what I'm saying? It's definitely a better vibe than everybody just going chunk, 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 chunk.
And when you say that, in my mind, I can hear the meters clearly picking up from that, and probably having those influences from Bo Diddley.
Yeah.
Right? You can the Nevilles, you can hear it. Yeah.
But the funny thing about that gig, too, Fred fucked with Bo a lot. You know, he loves to do that. And you know what? It's an icebreaker.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's really, I wouldn't know what to say. The guy said, oh, my God, you're a legend. I love you, man. You know, but Fred, I remember we were doing rehearsal at Soundcheck. And, you know, Bo turned around and said, okay, I want you to play that 2 and 4. Boom, pop. So Fred's playing it. I got moved to Hammond and piano, Hammond keyboard, yeah. At B3. Paul played rhythm, and we had a guy named, we were just like our first 6 months of the band. We had Paul Clement on bass. This is before Steve Walters. He knew he was temporary. He played in a band called Woodenhead.
Yeah.
And but long story short, start that chunk, 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 chunk. And Fred, in the middle of it, starts doing the toms, boom, ba-doom, ba-doom. And Bo stops and turns around and looks him in the eye. And Fred just, that smile, that little kid, you know, on the drum set, he's 9 years old. Yeah. Like, Sly! And he goes, oh, we're going to have a good night.
Yeah. That's awesome. I want to honor your time, and you and I want to get on with hearing some good music and relaxing on the boat here. But I did want to ask just a little bit. You mentioned Lonesome Travelers.
We can do part 2.
Yeah, we can do part 2. There you go. Do you guys still get together sometimes with that? Do you still do Lonesome Travelers, or just
catch
a gig when you can?
Yeah. We made sure we're not going to. That's going to ever go away.
It's such a fun.
We're going to still write together. I think we'll even do. We've even talked about doing another Lonesome Travelers record. Just getting together. I've just been living out in California, and it's been hard. I don't live in New Orleans anymore, so it's hard to get together. You have to, your time's precious, and you know, you have to make the best of it when I'm in New Orleans and get together. And also, I'll still get together with James from Red Rockers, and we still rehearse the old stuff because we want to do a reunion show at some point.
Nice.
So we want to be prepared. The only drag with that is Patrick's disappeared off the face of the planet, and Jim lives in Ireland.
Oh, so that makes it a little tough.
Yeah, so it looks a little tough.
Well, and you mentioned L.A., and you got the L.A. Dodgers cap on at the moment. But I think that's something people probably don't know about you, that you also score soundtracks for movies.
Yes, yeah, I do a commercial work. I basically started a library. I figured it out real quick when I got out there that you either beat them, you can beat them, or you can join them. You know?
Sure.
And my take on it was I had a lot of good advice. Vance the Generous was very kind to me when I was out there and set up some meetings with the heads of music departments, like at Telepictures and Warner Brothers and stuff. And basically what they said is, like, you know, don't try to score orchestral stuff. Like, don't be Hans Zimmer. You do rock stuff really, and rockabilly and all that kind of stuff really well. Piano stuff, you could do new age stuff, stick to that. That should be your focus. So that's what I started doing, was writing rock riffs. So I've got a library full of these rock riffs that could be turned into songs, possibly.
Sure.
You know, but yeah, and I've got a few. I've done a Neutrogena commercial, American Express, some sports facility, I can't remember what it was called. But, you know, yeah, and my music's still available. It's licensed. I license it myself. And I learned a lot about the business, too, a lot more than I had thought I knew.
Sure. And yeah. I don't suppose you guys stay in the, you know, rock business is not an easy business. You guys have been doing it a long, long time.
Well, you know, if anything happens, you know, you're not on the road anymore.
Yeah.
Let's hope not. Our fingers crossed that one of us gets really sick. You want some backup, you know, and I don't good. Do good swinging hammers, and I mean, I could, I guess. It's another job, career. I don't want to. I love music too much.
Well, and as a fan, I love seeing you guys on the road, seeing you perform as Cowboy Mouth and individually. You know, I think you're right. Maybe we'll do a part 2 sometime. We'll get you and Paul together, maybe, and talk about songwriting and that kind of thing. And look, for listeners, we're going to get, we've been talking with John Thomas Griffiths from Cowboy Mouth. We'll do a show at some point. It turns out communication on a ship is harder than you would think.
Uh-huh.
I'll hook up with Fred LeBlanc at some point and talk about Cowboy Mouth from his perspective. Griff, I just want to say thanks so much for taking the time to do this.
Mark, talk to me anytime. Yeah. I'm glad you said something. You know, I really enjoy this. I love talking to you. You're a great fan. I mean, you're very musical, intelligent. I don't know how we say it. Musically inclined person that knows what he's talking about. It's easier to talk to you than some guy that goes, just tell me if it goes through the paces.
This is not the 8-minute you're going through Atlanta show.
I appreciate it. Thanks.
It's, I think the Beyond Bourbon Street is all about sharing New Orleans with people who love New Orleans, whether they're here in the city or not, from the perspective of those of us who know and love it. And one of the things that I love about you and love about Cowboy Mouth is Cowboy Mouth is a rock band from New Orleans. But you're not from New Orleans, and you're every bit as New Orleans as
anybody.
You know,
I'm going to tell you something. I'll leave you with this, I guess. When I moved to New Orleans from New Jersey, I was a junior in high school, 16 years old, well, 15. My dad came to the kitchen table and said, hey, we're moving to New Orleans. And I was like, where is that? What's that? And the only reference I had was I was a huge Mark Twain fan in high school, and I read all his books. Yeah. Life in the Mississippi was one of my favorite books by Mark Twain. And it was all about it had this image. I was in Boy Scouts and Sea Scouts. I was, outdoors guy, and I thought of building a raft. As soon as they said, I'll build a raft and float from my aunt's house in Memphis down to New Orleans, and they can pick me up on the levee. Well, you get down there, and you're like, you look at the river, and you're going, maybe not. No, I don't know what I'm doing, But it was an eye-opening experience. But what I realized I wanted to also tell you that when you're young and like one of these northern states, New England states, a lot of the kids, well, at least when I was growing up, where they were really in a nitty-gritty dirt band, the Dead, basically bluegrass in general. And so I picked up the banjo and took lessons, figured I could fit in, with some of these guys, playing guitars. It wasn't until I got to New Orleans that I realized, wow, okay, it makes sense now. I'm getting the full education, the full ride. This is going to top it off. I'm going to get to see the meters, the funky, the radiators, all this stuff is going to. And I didn't realize why kids were all coming from the north to go to Tulane and Loyola until I got there. And I was like, oh, I get it. Uh-huh. Okay. So I got to thank my parents, God bless them, that they gave me this musical educational love.
There's a lot of northern kids.
You can't buy this, It's a treat. I can't say enough about just New Orleans' influence on me. It just rounded everything out.
Well, and you hear it in the music. You hear it in your individual songs. You hear it in Cowboy Mouth. And you mentioned that. We'll start to wrap it up. But we are again in the Gulf of Mexico, looking at some pretty big waves right now.
No land in sight.
And we're going to head up the mouth of the river tonight.
Yes.
And that's always been a draw for me, is being in the river and thinking about, hey, that's your job. The song, right? But it is that sort of bringing it full circle. Again, man, there are artists all around us. I don't know about you. I'm ready for a drink and some good music.
Yes, sir.
So for all you listeners, I really appreciate it. Again, I hope you've enjoyed this visit with Griff, learning a little bit about Cowboy Mouth behind the scenes. And until next time, laissez le bon temps rouler.
Adios.
Man, I had a fun time sailing across the Gulf of Mexico on the rock boat and talking with Griff. I've been a fan of Cowboy Mouth from the beginning, but I never really knew much about him. He doesn't talk too much on stage, and he rarely gives interviews, so it was a real honor to sit down with Griff and talk music. Be sure to check out his work with Cowboy Mouth, as well as his solo stuff, and his collaborations with Paul Sanchez. By the way, I mentioned in the interview that I had talked to Paul way back in episode 23, so I'll put a link in the show notes to that one if you want to check that out as well. I'll interview Fred LeBlanc in a future episode, but we can never quite catch up on the ship. It turns out it's a lot tougher than you might think. In any case, you can find the notes for today's episode over at beyondbourbonst.com/59, including the links to John's music, both individually and with Cowboy Mouth. If you want help planning your own trip to New Orleans, don't forget about our paid travel consult service. It can really help when you want to get into the details and maximize your time. Find out more over at beyondbourbonst.com/travel. If you want to hear more shows like this one, please subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. And now we're on Spotify, too. New episodes are available every other Wednesday. If you're enjoying the show, please share it with someone else who loves New Orleans as much as you and me. And one more time, until next time, laissez le bon temps rouler.
Thanks for listening to the Beyond Bourbon Street podcast. Find us anytime at beyondbourbonst.com.